Hello again and welcome back. What social life lessons can we learn from the insect world? There may be more of them than you might think. We're going to be talking about that with specific reference to the bee. What can be learned about social life from the study of them? In fact, it's going to be the subject of a discussion, a conversation this evening at the Donald Danforth Plant Science Center. It's billed as a discussion about what can be learned about the social life of bees. Joining me in studio to put bees into a different and perhaps multidimensional perspective are Dr. James Carrington, president of the Donald Danforth Plant Science Center, and Gene Robinson, director of the Institute for Genomic Biology and the Bee Research Facility at the University of Illinois. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Yeah, pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
Can we really talk for 20 minutes about bees?
Oh, please don't get me started. We easily can. What would you like to talk about?
Well, that's what I want to get from you. What should we be talking about? I mean, we all have our image of bees going from flower to flower and such. What should we be talking about, particularly with regard to the impact on our lives?
Mm-hmm. Well, we can start with the image you just conjured up, bees going from flower to flower. You see them working seemingly solitary fashion by themselves, just going about their ways. But if you could follow them, you would follow them back to the hive. They live with about 40,000 other individuals. They live with the queen. They live with a whole generation of baby bees, the brood, and all of them are interacting constantly in order to be able to make a living in a very complex world. It's very hard to get enough food to eat if you're living only off of flowers. So bees have evolved a variety of social mechanisms to coordinate their activities. For example, if a bee comes home full of nectar, her gut is full of nectar, she will give some of it to other bees to have them taste a little of it, and then she will literally tell them where she has been using a set of symbolic movements and sounds to give them information on the distance, the direction, and the quality of the food.
Is it always a she?
All the bees that are involved in doing work in the hive are shes, yes. And there are about 1,000 or so male bees who exist solely to mate with new queens. And as far as we know, do nothing else. Sorry, guys.
This we're talking about the honeybee here.
Yes.
What about bumblebees, other varieties, if you will?
There are about 20,000 bees in the world, and really only a few of them are social. All of them make a living off of flowers. They are all pollinators to one extent or another. Some are focusing on just a couple of different plants, and then the more social bees are the ones that pollinate and visit many different kinds, including many of our crop plants. One-third of the food that we eat is a result of pollination by insects, primarily honeybees.
We can talk about colony bee collapse in just a moment and the threat that that poses. But Dr. Carrington, why did you think it was important to have this conversation this evening about bees?
Yeah. Well, before I answer that, I need to point out to you and your listeners, you've got the Michael Jordan of the bee world here in Gene Robinson. We're very lucky to have him visiting for the day. The reason he's visiting the Danforth Center and participating in the conversation series is because bees are absolutely essential to our diets, our agriculture, literally our way of life. And let me just give you a few stats. One-third of all the food you eat is the result of pollination by bees or other pollinating insects. The value of that pollination in our agriculture is about $29, $30 billion a year. If you took bees out of the equation or out of the ecosystems in which we do agriculture, you would lose, let me just give you a brief list, you would lose almonds, peaches, oranges, a lot of apples, a lot of cherries, blueberries, sunflower, avocados, watermelon, squash. The list goes on and on. About 100 different agricultural crops depend in part or wholly on pollination, mostly by bees.
Well, how serious a threat to all of that is this issue with bees just disappearing? The colony bee collapse, that's what they call it. I guess that's the correct term.
Yeah. From an agricultural and from an economic perspective, it's a very important issue. It's an issue that is still, we have a long ways to go before we understand it. And it's part, Gene will describe this in much more detail, The colony collapse disorder is part of a larger set of issues in managing our bees. Our bees are literally travelers going around the United States and in other parts of the world, going from country to country in some cases, pollinating different crops at different times of the year. Colony collapse disorder is has gotten a lot of attention, and Gene has a lot to say about that.
All right. Well, let's pick it up, Gene, if you would.
Yeah. So we've been seeing for the past 10 years steady declines in the population of honeybees due to the losses that have been collectively called colony collapse disorder. As Jim said, we are a long ways from understanding exactly what's going on, but the contours of the problem are coming into focus, and they are as follows. We are stressing our bees with a variety of different stressors and creating a situation where one more stressor comes along and then you have a collapse. Because the colony works in such an integrated and intricate manner where the effects, where the actions of some bees affect the other bees, then the stress puts a demand on the entire colony until you finally get a crash in the population. Mm-hmm. So we've identified multiple factors that are at play, and these are pesticides, pathogens, parasites, and poor nutrition.
Poor nutrition as a result of the pesticides and some of the other things you've talked about?
Well, they all interact and interact in different ways. There in many agricultural areas, there's an increased need or desire to control weeds, so there are fewer flowering plants in agricultural areas. And that creates a stress for bees. By itself, it may not be a problem, but throw in a high viral load or throw in a high level of parasites, throw in exposure to a pesticide, and then you get the ingredients for a real problem.
It doesn't sound like an easy problem to solve.
It's not. You're exactly right. When you have a combinatorial problem, teasing out how they interact with each other is really difficult. Yeah. We're also learning that there are synergies, that one stress by itself would have, say, a mild effect, but together with another one, it has an effect that's not two times greater, but four times greater.
What actually happens when we talk about collapse? Are we talking about them bees by the thousands just dropping dead? I mean, is that what we're talking about? They disappear, go off and die?
Well, we're seeing that colony collapse disorder is a catch-all term for a variety of problems. The end point is the same. The colony's dead. There are no bees that are living and doing their jobs. How they get there, where those bees are factors that differ. So when colony collapse disorder first burst onto the scene, the real mystery was that the bees were gone. They were just literally gone. And that had to do, we now understand, with bees that went out to forage that just could never make it back. They were in a compromised state, and they weren't able to make it back. But there also are collapses that are related to bees where you just see a pile of dead bees in front of the colony, where you see dead bees inside the colony due to different reasons.
You would think that you could learn something about what was going on from the honey that is left behind.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. And there are chemical analyses of honey and also of beeswax. And it shows that bees are exposed to a large number of chemical toxicants in our environment, or I should say chemicals that in reasonable doses may not be causing serious problems, but at higher doses could be. And it turns out, unfortunately, that beeswax, this natural, pristine substance that we all hold in great affection, is a great substance for accumulating bioactive chemicals, environmental chemicals, and then putting them in high concentrations in the beehive.
How do you do your research?
So what we do is we have a large number of honeybee colonies out in the field, and we are focused on understanding the brain of the honeybee and how it produces social behavior. This is a question that has strong fundamental interest, so understanding how brains work is one of the grand challenges in science. And the honeybee has a very special place in this endeavor because it has a tiny brain, only a million brain cells or neurons, and yet it's capable of producing intricate social behavior. So honeybees are classic overachievers. And so they are creating complex social behavior with a brain, a fraction, it's literally a fraction of the size of ours. It's a grass seed with a million neurons. Our brain is billions and billions of neurons. And so we're trying to understand how it is that the genes inside the brain give rise to a functioning brain, and how the brain then powers the individual's behavior, and then how the individuals then form a society. So it's kind of a Russian doll's nested study design.
And once we understand this information better than we do now, how do we apply what we've learned to us? I assume that there's some relevance there.
Yes. Yeah. So bees are unique in that they are important for their own sake. So what we learn about the bee brain and its behavior can be applied to the agricultural context, the context that Dr. Carrington was just speaking about before. And also they serve as a model for understanding social behavior in general. So for example, one finding that we just made that has general relevance is that there are genes in the brain that respond to social challenges, particular threats. And if you compare some of those genes to other organisms, for example, stickleback fish and mice, you find that there are a set of genes that are engaged in all three of those brains in response to social threats. These three animals that I mentioned, the honeybee, the stickleback fish, and the mouse, have over 600 million years of evolutionary divergence, and yet we see some modules, some genetic modules that are activated in response to threats that are the appropriate threats for each of those species, suggesting that there's a lot of deep conservation, that there's a genetic toolkit for responsiveness to social stimuli. This can be important because there are many mental illnesses that relate to problems with identifying social threats, social opportunities, distinguishing one social context from another. The more we can learn about the so-called social brain, the better we will be able to treat mental illness.
We are talking about bees, of course, but there must be similar kinds of research going on with other insects as well. I mean, we think of many of them having very unique and different kinds of qualities that perhaps we would want to emulate or learn more about. Is that true?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, nature has a bounty, and it's very important to pay attention to different species. Some of our most amazing technologies that we use in molecular biology, for example, come from enzymes that were discovered in bacteria that live in hot springs. And astute observers finding these then had amazing ideas for how to put them to use to create the biotechnology industry.
Can you give me any kind of an example?
Well, there's a method that's used to amplify genes. So if you want to study genes, genes are present in tiny amounts, and it's always helpful in any scientific endeavor to have more of whatever it is you're trying to study. Yeah. So there is a method that's called polymerase chain reaction, PCR, as it's abbreviated, that is based on enzymes that are employed by bacteria in their natural life to handle the basic machinery of their own life. These enzymes were identified, and then they were put into use. Now, every lab, if it doesn't have four or five, quote, PCR machines, it's not a lab. And it's even, you know, graduated to the point where you have the classic level of success where you say, I'm going to PCR something, you know, like Xerox something. That's how embedded it is. Started with a lowly bacteria.
Yeah. Where are we in this research in terms of, well, if we're looking at from 1 to 10, are we at 2 or are we at 8 or 9?
Which research? you know, there's just so much, there's so much going on. It's a very exciting and frustrating time in science in the United States. It's exciting because there's a sense that, especially in genomics, that the technologies have matured and are able to tackle really big problems in a variety of fields, in plant science, in agriculture, in health, and in energy, that we have a lot of tools, we have a lot of concepts that have matured, and yet the federal funding situation is very difficult and has really hampered progress. And we see our competitors worldwide investing far more in scientific infrastructure for training of new students and in establishing and extending technologies and economic development based on them.
Believe me, federal funding issues, that's not the first time that's come up on this program. With virtually every area that we discuss, it's an issue, funding of federal or otherwise. Dr. Carrington, I've learned a lot about bees today during this brief discussion. And this is, I guess, part of your job at the Science Center, is to let people know that this kind of research is going on and how important it is to our day-to-day lives. I mean, who knew that the bee could be so important to us?
That's right. The mission of the Danforth Center is to improve the human condition through plant science, but we interpret that very broadly and reaching out, educating, and engaging the public on topics like bees, bee behavior, and the role of bees in agriculture and biodiversity. That's an essential part of what we do. I want to add one thing on the notion of, or on the idea of, where are we at? Gene and his colleagues and many others in the field have done amazing basic science over the past 25 years. And to link that basic science to real applications or understanding of what's happening, say, in agriculture, colony collapse disorder, this is where we're at a point right now where we're actually going to be able to apply that knowledge in really meaningful ways. Gene has a number of examples relating to understanding the role of stress, how that's actually being manifested in something like colony collapse or decline of a hive.
We're going to have to save that imparting of that information for your event tonight. Thank you both, gentlemen, for being with us. Gene Robinson, welcome to St. Louis. Good to have you. And Dr. Carrington, great to see you again, and hope you have a great event tonight.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being with us. Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, when he'll talk with vocalist Brian Owens about the Soul of Ferguson Community Festival and with the authors of a new book of poetry and images reflecting the feelings of the Ferguson community in the months following the shooting death of Michael Brown. He'll also take a look at a new exhibition at UMSL's Gallery 210 titled Exposure 18, Nervous Laughter. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll have our legal roundtable panel with us. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Anya O'Connor, Aaron Dorr, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.